Hi, it's Megan. Before we get to the episode, I want to tell you the latest about the Unspeakeasy and our retreats for the rest of this year. Our Seattle retreat next month is full, but spots are available for several others, including our first ever co-ed retreat in Chicago on June 4th and 5th. That one will feature three guest speakers, including legendary free speech champion and former ACLU president Nadine Strossen, who also happens to be the guest on the podcast this week. You're about to hear her. We will also be joined by Eric Smith, professor of rhetorics and co-founder of Free Black Thought, and journalist and author Lisa Sellen Davis, who does extraordinary work on the new gender movement and has also been on the podcast very recently. A many-time visitor to this podcast, just like Eric. For information about this retreat, as well as our retreats this fall in Toronto and in upstate New York, go to theunspeakeasy.com. Space is limited. That's the whole idea. These things are small, so get in touch now.
Even on issues where we are constantly told that we are so retrograde and we're backsliding and we're never going to solve problems of racism or sexism, I dissent. I very strongly dissent.
Welcome to the Unspeakable Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Daum. My guest is legal scholar, former law professor, and legendary free speech advocate Nadine Strossen. Nadine was president of the American Civil Liberties Union from 1991 to 2008, and she's the author of many books, including Defending Pornography, which has just been reissued nearly 30 years after its original publication. She's the author of several other books, including Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship, and that came out in 2018, and also Free Speech, What Everyone Needs to Know, which is a kind of pocket guide to free speech law. This is a really good conversation. It's wide-ranging. We talk about everything from pornography to campus speech codes, generational divides when it comes to ideas about words causing harm. And also we talk about changes in institutions like the ACLU. It's so good that I'm making almost all of it free to everyone. However, I will tell you that we got off on a fascinating and often very funny tangent toward the end about a subject close to my heart, the subject of choosing not to have children. Nadine also made that choice, and she talks candidly and often hilariously about what was behind that and how she feels about it now that she's in her 70s. If you are not a paying subscriber, and if you're hearing me say this right now, you are not yet, you can become one at megandaum.substack.com and hear the entirety of this conversation. In the meantime, enjoy it. Here is most of my conversation with Nadine Strossen. Nadine Strossen, welcome to The Unspeakable.
I'm so delighted to be here, Megan.
There's so many things to talk about. You are a leading figure in issues related to free speech, constitutional law, and civil liberties. You were the president of the ACLU for a long time, from 1991 to 2008, I think.
Correct.
You were a law professor for a long time. And even though you're not teaching anymore, I know you're very much out and about talking with students. And so I want to start with this question. We're going to cover a lot of ground here, but I do want to start here. When you got involved with issues of free speech, I'm tempted to say the free speech movement, but it's not really a movement, at least I hope not anymore. So when you started thinking about this stuff and working in this arena, presumably back in the 1970s, did you ever think you would fast forward 50 years and see these things being debated and discussed the way they are now?
I don't want to give myself too much credit when I say yes, Megan, because the reason I think I did anticipate this situation is something that I had realized throughout my activism with the ACLU, as encapsulated by one of our mottos, which went back to the ACLU's principal founder way back at the beginning of the 20th century, Roger Baldwin, who said, "No fight for civil liberties ever stays won." And, you know, an even earlier capturing of that sentiment is often attributed to Thomas Jefferson when he said, "Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And even when I first became actively involved in the ACLU, shortly after I graduated from law school, way back in 1975, the ACLU handled one of its most controversial and most consequential cases. It remains so to this day, the so-called Skokie case, in which the ACLU, famously or infamously, depending on your perspective, came to the defense of free speech principles in a case where the immediate direct beneficiaries were a nasty group of neo-Nazis who wanted to purvey their white supremacist anti-Semitic ideas and expression in Skokie, Illinois, a town near Chicago that had not only a large Jewish population, but many of them, considering this was 1977, many of them were Holocaust survivors. And I was very surprised to learn that the ACLU had been handling similar cases going all the way back to its earliest years, the 1920s and the 1930s, generating the same controversy among not only the general public, but also among ACLU members. In our earliest decades, we were defending free speech rights for fascists, including fascists who were spouting racist ideologies. And there is even a historic brochure that goes back to either the 1920s or 1930s, why the ACLU defends freedom of speech, even for fascist anti-civil libertarian speech. You know, then in the 1980s, with the first proposals of so-called hate speech codes on college campuses, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, it's not even a decade since the Skokie debate, and here we are all over again. So I would be surprised, quite frankly, Megan, if I did not have to try to re-explain the same ideas for each subsequent generation. No, for every individual person, right? These are not self-evident propositions, and you can't, in a soundbite, explain why there should be freedom, even for the thought that we hate. And in fairness, as somebody who tries to the best of my human capabilities, necessarily limited cognitive abilities, I try to be open-minded. So I personally benefit from the constant re-examination that occurs through the constant discussions I have on campus and elsewhere. If I can, Megan, I loved teaching constitutional law, and my students apparently loved me, judging by the faculty evaluations. So I want to make clear that the only reason why I resigned from my full-time tenured faculty position and became an emerita professor was precisely so that I could visit all other campuses all around the country. I was already on the campus lecture circuit, but teaching a couple days a week in New York was rather challenging, and I was tired of having to take red eyes back and forth from Europe to New York, from the West Coast to New York. And I decided that I would rather spend the rest of my active life teaching and advocating about free speech and related principles to a larger audience than my own students. It means that I can no longer teach other aspects of constitutional law, like the dormant commerce clause. And you couldn't tell how much.
Oh, no.
I know how much I miss that.
Okay. Well, before we get to sort of what kinds of conversations you're having with students, and I've had a lot of conversations with students as a teacher myself, I want to sort of go back to, you know, early in your career. I'm curious, what were the issues that were animating you as a young legal scholar? I mean, I know you were very involved in the feminist movement in the 70s and the 80s. You've talked about how Ruth Bader Ginsburg came and spoke when you were in law school, and that was sort of your introduction to the ACLU. That's where she had founded the ACLU Women's Rights Project. What was the speech that you felt was being suppressed at that time?
If I may go back even earlier, I was always aware of any speech suppression that hit my radar screen, starting from a much younger age, before I had any legal knowledge at all. I deeply questioned and struggled against what seemed to me the injustice and arbitrariness of people who had power over me as far back as I can remember, my parents, my teachers, others in authority who tried to put substantive limits on what I could say. And at the same time, when I saw that happening to other people, it also struck me as unjust and unfair, not to mention unwise. And then I didn't realize it was also unconstitutional. But I remember during the 1960s, seeing footage of civil rights demonstrators being just brutally treated when they were trying simply to advocate for equal rights, for the civil rights statute, and against Jim Crow. That just struck me as deeply unjust. And then when I got to actually starting in middle school, junior high school, as we called it in those days, there were real crackdowns on the then nascent protest movement against the Vietnam War. And that even happened at my own school, where a social studies teacher who simply showed his students, including yours truly, a slideshow of images from the war, images that showed the suffering of civilians and the napalming of civilians without any text. That was extremely unpopular and controversial and led to a denunciatory editorial against him calling for his firing in the local newspaper. I wrote my first letter to the editor defending his free speech rights and the rights of the students to receive the perspective and imagery that he was showing us. I started a petition drive in defending his free speech. So I think I have always had, though, an understanding, and I don't know exactly where it came from, because as I say that, I'm wishing I could, if I knew where it came from, I would try to bottle it and distribute it, that what is at stake is not just the freedom to utter a particular message, but a freedom, I guess, because my awareness arose in the context, by definition, of speech from somebody who was powerless, me as a child and as a school student, the teacher voicing an unpopular perspective. So I guess I processed that as the general lesson, which is true, that whatever perspective or speaker is relatively powerless and or unpopular at a particular time in a particular place is the one that is going to suffer when there is unjustified power to suppress speech based on disfavor of the idea or of the speaker. And somehow I processed that general message so that when the unpopular speaker, when I was on campus, it was very much predictive of the situation that we see today. I was very strongly opposed to the Vietnam War, as I say, I didn't say that substantively, but I did support the teacher's perspective. And I actually, even when I was still in high school, I went around, I grew up in Minneapolis, a suburb of Minneapolis, and I was sent around the Twin Cities somehow to do debates about the Vietnam War, even as a kid, at a time when the war was very popular still, and the anti-war movement was just starting, it was quite unpopular. But then I continued to oppose the war. But when I went to college in 1968, I very much disagreed with the stance that was being taken by many other students who shared my anti-war views, but who were protesting and objecting to and seeking to stop speakers coming to campus from the military, from the government, from the defense industry. I felt very strongly that their perspectives should be heard. And, you know, kind of a forecast of the split today between classical liberals or even traditional political liberals on the one hand and so-called progressives on the other hand. In those days, we had a similar split. That we liberals were already called liberals, but those on the left were called radical. That was the term du jour. And on campus, you know, most of the students who were active in the anti-war movement, most of the student activists identified with and were members of so-called radical organizations. Today, they would be called progressive, like SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, many brands of socialists and Marxists and even communists. And already I was fairly unpopular and subject to criticism, even among my fellow anti-war activists. I remember one of them calling me, you know, a bourgeois liberal, which he meant as an insult.
Yeah, that's fighting words for sure in the Ivy League, ironically.
So I guess, you know, I'm saying it really is, to me, much more recycled maybe than even many people in younger generations are aware of.
That is fascinating because I think that we sit here now and we have this perception that until very recently, if you were on the side of free speech, you were on the left because it was the right or, you know, Christian fundamentalism or, you know, some kind of religious powers that be that were censoring people, that were sort of being puritanical. But that's actually not totally accurate.
I am shaking my head so vigorously. I can go through every single decade of my adult life and give you examples of major free speech challenges that were coming from the left, as well as major ones that were coming from the right. The only difference between them is which speech they sought to suppress. You know, and I'm looking at the cover of the newest book that I've published. It's actually an old book that was just republished as and part of the NYU Classics series called Defending Pornography, Free Speech, Sex, and the Fight for Women's Rights. That book emanated from a period that started in the late 1970s, continued at least through much of the 90s, and during which there were these odd bedfellows from left to right who had very different views about every issue relating to sexuality and freedom and women's rights and roles in society, you name it, but who teamed up in jointly using the stigmatizing term pornography, which has no specific legal meaning, but we use it in a way that is an epithet, right? Whatever sexual expression you don't like, you call pornography. And they were very successful to some extent legally, but to an even larger extent culturally in embedding left to right what we're still seeing today, which is attacks on sexual expression. So from the left, it was the so-called radical feminist led by a law professor named Catherine MacKinnon and a writer named Andrea Dworkin, who had a concept of what they thought should be illegal pornography, sexual expression that demeaned or subordinated or degraded or dehumanized women. And then on the right, I think probably best embodied by Attorney General Ed Meese, the United States Attorney General under President Ronald Reagan. He spearheaded something called the Meese Pornography Commission. He worked with a cultural and religious right conservatives who opposed sexual expression that they saw as undermining the, quote, traditional American family, or the traditional nuclear family. Those were the terms that they used. And both sides, even though they had completely opposite views about exactly which sexual expression should be outlawed as pornography, they were happy to make common cause. And, you know, I could give you so many other examples. I think I did already allude to the movement that started in the early 1980s from a left law professors to come up with this concept of hate speech codes on college campuses. And that quickly swept through academia. We had people of the left, for very laudable, understandable reasons, falling for this new argument that if we want to have true, meaningful equality on campus for members of groups that traditionally have been excluded from or marginalized in our campuses, including racial minorities and women, then we must shield them from hate speech that undermines their dignity and equality. And even though that movement also foundered, as did the so-called feminist anti-pornography movement, both were fairly quickly struck down as unconstitutional, the measures that they advocated struck down as unconstitutional. But they laid roots in our campus culture that have continued to bear, in my view, poisonous fruit. Even though, you know, the movement to suppress speech that was disfavored seemed to somewhat go into abeyance, maybe starting in the late 90s, but as very well chronicled by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt in their terrific book, The Coddling of the American Mind, I think they use the year 2014 as when this really burst forth again. But, you know, having been nurtured in the campus climate during those decades, you know, since then we've had the pandemic and we're all a little bit familiar with viruses. So I think of it as in the 90s, we used the term political correctness, which was basically what we now call wokeness, right? And the political correctness movement came under not only great legal defeat, but it was very strongly criticized culturally. And it seemed to go away. But now I had the feeling that it came back. And just as, you know, as a virus comes back and then
yes,
seems it's stronger
than ever. Well, that's the thing, like with political correctness, it was an in-joke among the left, really. Like, it was, I feel like it was a way to kind of signal that you knew what was right, but you were also kind of sophisticated enough to make fun of it. You know, they would have like books like Politically Correct Fairy Tales, where they would retell the, you know, stories with the, you know, person is vertically challenged. You know, they're not a dwarf or an elf. They're, you know, whatever.
Right.
And yeah, somewhere along the way, it became very serious and very much weaponized. So, I mean, that's why I was curious kind of when it's really refreshing to hear that like the political valence has always been complex. Because, you know, I was in college in the late 80s and the early 90s, and we made jokes about political correctness. Okay. And then kind of went away. And, you know, one of the things that I've written a lot about, and I'm really curious to hear your thoughts about maybe in a couple minutes, is the way like the women's movement, you know, kind of receded a little bit and we went into this raunch culture and we had this like kind of, you know, Girls Gone Wild, like extremely kind of you know, hyper-sexualized kind of cartoon depictions of sex and of women. And then the reaction to that was really strong. And that's kind of starts around 2011, 12, 13, 14. And, you know, I remember teaching some graduate students, I think it was around 2016 or 17 or something. And it was free speech week at the university, right? And I said, I made the mistake of telling the class, hey, it's free speech week. You guys should go hear these speakers, you know. Laura Kipnis, my friend, is going to give a talk about, you know, Title IX and sexual harassment and due process and all of this. And they looked at me as if I had suggested that they go to a Klan rally.
Wow.
And I'm wondering, like, what you are hearing from students now as you go around and talk about this.
Well, you know, the historical perspective, if I can just stay with that for a minute, Megan, because one of the aspects of the feminist anti-pornography movement was that it was ultimately a very anti-sex movement as well. They saw sex, first of all, there's no such thing as consensual sex. If you think that you're voluntarily, even joyfully welcoming, dare I say, even initiating sex, you are a victim of false consciousness, because by definition, women are inherently degraded by sex.
Was so, Catherine MacKinnon saying that, or just Andrea Dworkin?
Oh, no, both of them. And in my book, I assure you, I have exact quotes, because I do not want to overstate the case. I don't want to engage in hyperbole. Exact quotes. And for that reason, by the way, many people are surprised to learn this, because I think if they think of MacKinnon, they think feminism, and feminism they equate, among other things, with being pro-choice.
Yeah, and she was also with Geoffrey Maison, was her boyfriend, right?
Well, so, MacKinnon strongly opposed abortion rights, because once women had access to abortion, it took away a disincentive to have sex. I kid you not.
Oh my gosh.
So, there are a lot of anti-feminist, as well as anti-free speech and anti-sex aspects of that whole philosophy. So to that extent, it was very refreshing to see this younger generation of women and feminists being so sex positive. But I remember, you know, when you were talking, I looked at my phone to see the date. I remember something that's very telling. The documentary movie about Larry Flint, which was a fantastic movie, The People versus Larry Flint. And it's really a fabulous documentary about free speech issues in general, civil rights issues in general. Many people don't know that he was attacked by a white supremacist because of his strong anti-racism activism. And there were fabulous actors in the film who did a great job. But the film was very much tarred by Gloria Steinem and other leading feminists at the time. Anyway, I knew Larry Flint because he was a big supporter of all of the ACLU's work, you know, not only freedom of speech, but also anti-racism and other equality work and work in the criminal justice system. Anyway, as a favor to me, after the film came out, he came to New York Law School, where I was then teaching, to do a presentation. And, today I don't think you could have gotten away with that, right? I mean,
no.
He would not have been allowed anywhere near campus, but it was the positive reaction from the young women, as well as the men in the audience, was just really, to me, thrilling.
And what year was this? Sorry, this is important.
It came out in 1996.
Yeah, and we should say it wasn't a documentary. It was a feature. It was like a bio. It was a biographical drama. Mila Schwarman directed.
Yes, exactly. And Woody Harrelson played Larry Flint, and Courtney Love played his wife. I mean, it was really terrific performances. And I remember Larry Flint offered to sign people's books. And I do remember a couple female law students lining up, and they were asking him to sign their bodies. And
oh my God.
I don't know if the name Wendy Kaminer means anything.
Of course.
To you.
I'm dysfunctional.
Okay, so Wendy, you know, another pro-speech feminist was in the audience. She was a friend and colleague of mine through the ACLU and other organizations. And Wendy was the first person who really gave me a very sobering thought about this. I said, Wendy, isn't it this wonderful that they are so pro-sex and pro-free speech? And Wendy said, but I think it may be because they've lost sight of the feminist message, you know, words to that effect, that, yeah, they care about maybe they're probably not even thinking about free speech. They do care about sex, but maybe they're not processing the gender discrimination and equality issues that are also of concern to us. Anyway, I've taken us down a different path. I know you were asking.
No, that's fascinating. That's what I was wondering. So was it shortly after the film? So that would have been kind of mid to late 90s?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that it's very relevant that this was before the digital age, really. So we're still in the era where Playboy, you know, there was good writing. You really could go there for the articles, right? So,
yes.
You know, pornography had a very different kind of tone and texture. I mean, the dimensions of it were not yet what we're dealing with now. You know, I do want to talk about that a little bit. I mean, I remember when Defending Pornography came out. It was 95. Was that when it
exactly
was
right.
published? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was 25 years old and I was, you know, really interested in these things. And that was a really important book. I mean, I can still picture it on my shelf. You know, I think that like one of the things I run into, because I tend to be very nostalgic about that time, the way we are about our 20s. And so when I talk to young people now, they'll say things like, well, it's easy for you to have that stuff roll off your back and, you know, be able to separate Larry Flint, you know, speaking to law students versus Larry Flint, what he has done as a person and, you know, what the images he has presented of women. It's easy for you to make those distinctions because you are fill in the blank. You are privileged. You have a position of power. You have a certain kind of temperament that it just doesn't happen to bother you. But what about all the people who don't have that temperament? What about people who are vulnerable? And this gets back to something I was thinking about when you were talking about when you were young. You know, you were, I don't want to say that you were a contrarian, but you were, you know, you were not afraid of conflict and you weren't afraid of people being angry with you. Do you think that you just have a certain kind of temperament and that the people who are kind of able to speak up about these things just happen to have like certain kinds of personalities?
That's an interesting question, Megan. What you're making me think of are some statements that I included in a book I published a couple of years ago about hate speech. And after all, the so-called radical, so-called feminist anti-pornography concept, I mean, they see pornography that they are targeting as a specific kind of hate speech, right? Sexually explicit speech that is demeaning or degrading or hateful toward women in particular. So similar arguments are made in the larger hate speech context that people like you and I can't possibly fathom the harm that is done through hearing a word or an idea that is hateful to a marginalized, vulnerable person. And I had a whole chapter in the hate speech book in which I quote not only experts on psychology and mental health, but also people who have been leaders of minority rights organizations, and even people who were not powerful, who were supportive of minority rights, who make this point that whether we as an individual experience expression as demeaning or neutral or positive turns on our own perception, and our own perception is a very complex matter that results from not only your status, right? And I think those status factors are what the complainants are referring to, but also your own sense of self, which even an unpowerful person, you know, myself as a young child, or I see so many just incredibly brave students today who dare to stand up against their, not only their teacher, but their school board or their library board protesting for students' rights, that basically you can have control over the impact that the words have on you. And maybe you need certain educational resources to do that. Certainly that facilitates it. Maybe certain technological resources to do that. But basically, I think it does come down to fundamental concepts that I wish would be, they certainly could be, instilled by every parent from the earliest age, by every educator from the earliest age. You know, and I think in some ways that perspective was attempted to be inculcated by parents throughout the ages through that old nursery rhyme, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me." And obviously, they did not mean by that words cannot hurt you. All of us are hurt by words all the time. I just read a negative review of my book and I was deeply hurt.
That's right. That's a violence. Yes.
Right. Violence, harm, trauma. But what they were saying, it was a normative point. It wasn't a factual point. We shouldn't let words hurt us. And even as children, we have the capacity to rise above that, to understand that we are not reduced to whatever insulting epithet somebody might choose to hurl at us. One of the pithiest ways of summarizing all of that, which I quoted in my hate speech book, was from Eleanor Roosevelt. And she said, nobody can hurt your feelings unless you give them permission to do it.
Yeah. And we talk about this a lot on this podcast. John Haidt's been on. And a couple weeks ago, I had Ted and Courtney Ballacher, who are the filmmakers of The Coddling of the American Mind.
And that's such a great film.
Documentary. It's so good. They did such a good job with it. I wasn't quite sure how they were going to do that. I wasn't sure how they were going to turn that book into a film, but it's really, really good. And we hear a lot about how education has changed. K-12 education has changed. Things like the anti-bullying initiative that started, I guess, in the 90s, which I think there's a lot of good there. I mean, bullying was really bad when I was growing up. I mean, the stuff that like teachers and administrators just kind of turned a blind eye to would be shocking in today's context. But I wonder what your thoughts are about like, what is the root cause here? Is it parenting? Is it teaching? Is it just kind of the effects of social media and the waters that we're swimming? Like, do you blame like DEI? Like, what are your thoughts just about the way that we're talking about this stuff?
Megan, this to me is way beyond my expertise as a lawyer and educator. I think that the factors that are responsible are among the ones that you cite are cultural factors, and that the answers have to come from anthropologists and sociologists and social psychologists.
Those people are the most captured, though, of course. Right?
Well, I mean, I'm for example, what are the experts that are quoted in The Coddling of the American Mind? And they list the factors that you noted. I suppose one could go a level deeper and say, well, why is it that parents started to become more protective? Everything is so complicated. It could be because there was greater media attention to crimes against children, including sexual exploitation of children. And I know it's extremely debated whether there were, in fact, more crimes and whether the media was just disproportionately creating a so-called moral panic about it. This definitely, we have to say this, it doesn't go without saying, not only is bullying bad, of course, any exploitation or crime of or crime against even one child is a tragedy and to be condemned. But we don't want to exaggerate the problem because then that leads to unjustified policy responses that have negative repercussions, including even undermining children's welfare because you're ignoring what might be more significant contributing factors to children's psychological and physical well-being. But, since you and I were talking about the 1990s, that is when the internet first hit the media and public and political radar screen, right? It had been known to scientists before that, but in the early 90s, the general public and the press become aware of it and politicians. And at the time, we were going through what many people now call a moral panic about child sexual abuse. There were all of these scandals that turned out to have been completely fabricated, and people's lives were just ruined who were falsely accused of the most horrific crimes against children. But bring together the confluence of a new powerful communications medium, which people throughout history have always been afraid of, whatever expression they consider the most dangerous at that moment in time is the one that they want want to censor on that medium. So the expression that was the most feared at that time was anything to do with sex, and particularly anything to do with sex and kids. And not surprisingly, therefore, how does Congress greet this brave new medium? By sweeping through with almost no negative votes on either side of the aisle, a 1996 law called the Communications Decency Act, which would have outlawed online any so-called indecent or patently offensive expression. Just think about how enormously over vague and over broad those concepts were. The ACLU immediately went to court to challenge it, and our clients included, you know, gay rights organizations, women's rights organizations, human rights organizations, ourselves, because a lot of the expression we put online could well be considered indecent or patently offensive, all of the mainstream publishers and mainstream press organizations. And even though it was, you know, almost nobody dared speak against it in the political sphere, the Clinton administration defended it in the Supreme Court. Thank goodness the Supreme Court sided with us 9-0. And with a lot of, you know, really wonderful language that continues to be relevant, that this sexually oriented expression, far from being necessarily harmful to people, including young people, actually has a lot of positive benefits, including for young people. It may even be, you know, far from being dangerous to their health and lives, may actually be health and affirming and protective and even life-saving. You think of a gay kid in some isolated community back then who didn't have any real community to go to for support, that the online information and communities could be a lifeline. Same thing with information about sex, STDs, and about contraception and abortion. When we were having problems with, you know, spread of STDs and unwanted, unintended pregnancies among minors.
Yeah, there was a sense then that if you were for free speech, you were an adult, right? You were able to sort of, you know, separate fact from feeling. I hate to fall back on that framing, but that was what people did. And, you know, but now we're in a situation where, like, a lot of people who have a lot of power in these institutions and in the media want to suppress speech because it's supposedly harming people. And I just, you know, again, I'm not entirely sure how we got there. And it feels to me like there's no adults in the room. I mean, do you ever feel that way?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting that you're using the term adults in a very different way from the way I was referring to, which is people draw a bright line and say, if you haven't achieved the age of adulthood, then we can stop you from seeing certain expression. And I very strongly, I know you do too, defend minors' free speech rights. But, you know, some minors are adults in the way that you're using it, and some adults are not adults in the sense of taking our own a proud responsibility for choosing not only what to see and what not to see, and rejecting anybody else's assertions of the prerogative to deprive us of those choices, but also taking control of and being responsible for our own reactions in a way that I was talking about earlier. And I completely, you know, I do want to say that my concept of freedom for speech and in every other sphere is one that recognizes that not all of us have the same opportunities and facilities and resources for exercising that freedom. Not everybody is born with the writing talents that you have, Megan. So I can't express myself right. No, but I mean, in all seriousness, but every single right can, as a practical matter, be more effectively exercised by some people rather than others, including those who are financially better off than others. And our mission, speaking for myself and others who advocate, you know, full fundamental freedoms for everybody. We have to strive to empower everybody as to live up to their individual maximum potential in enjoying freedom of speech and thought and all these other freedoms, not just in theory, but in reality. And that is, to me, one of the most heartbreaking aspects of what is going on, starting in K through 12 and continuing through college. And such a brilliant point in both the film and the book version of Coddling of the American Mind. They're both outstanding and they're both very different, which I found, you know, like you, I was wondering, how could they turn this into a movie? They didn't quote, turn it into a movie. They made a movie about the same kinds of issues, but using very different resources and that movies have. And the tragedy there is you see people being miseducated in ways that disempower them, that make them feel more frail and more powerless and more unable to either listen to somebody else or to, let alone, to raise their own voices. And, you know, in the most recent survey that came out from FIRE, I don't remember whether I defined that, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE and College Pulse, which specializes in surveys and other data analysis of college campuses. For 5 years or so, they've been doing an annual assessment of the state of free speech on campuses in the United States. The most recent report came out in October of last year, and it was an exhaustive examination of 248 campuses. And there were so many heartbreaking conclusions in that report, but one of the most heartbreaking to me as an educator and civil liberties advocate is that the majority of students say that they feel less free and less comfortable to discuss, quote, sensitive, close quote, topics after matriculating and studying at college than before. So we're doing the opposite. We should be, you know, making people feel fearless and self-confident and have their own strong sense of dignity and resilience to engage in the conversation. And we're doing the opposite too often.
When you go around and talk with students, do you find that the ones that come to your event are the ones that are not that way? Or are they more curious? Or are they able to speak to you in a way that they wouldn't speak in the classroom? Like, what kinds of things are they saying to you?
I speak in different kinds of forums, but I very much strive, not only to preach to the choir. That's very, very important for me.
But it's so satisfying.
It really is important to speak to the choir too, especially when the free speech choir on so many campuses is a very small, embattled, unpopular minority.
Underground choir, yes.
Oh, that's a good way to describe it. So yes, so some of the events will be, you know, very small, intimate, by handpicked student leaders of free speech movements. And there's a different degree of candor from what would occur in a public session. But even in the public session, Megan, I strive to make it as diverse as possible in terms of who comes. And I do that in various ways, one of which is by speaking with faculty members and encouraging them to encourage their students to come. The other thing, a strategy that's been very successful, is to invite as participants in the program either faculty members or administrators and/or students who are very much associated with causes that unfortunately are too often seen as antithetical to free speech. In my view, they're completely interconnected to free speech. But for example, the head of the DEI program or leaders of minority groups on campus, our faculty members who specialize in my various kinds of minority studies. I, for many years now, have, anytime I get a speaking invitation, I have a form memo that goes out, and I state that my very strong preference for format is that I not do a conventional talking head lecture, which I, you know, I could easily do, but that I just find that a more interactive format is much more effective for many reasons, one of which is that it allows the involvement and engagement of somebody who has a different perspective. So it could be a faculty member who has a somewhat, you know, different perspective on free speech, or whose main concern is a DEI or equality concern, or concern about students' mental health, psychic well-being. And so that tends to draw people who would share that orientation or be attracted to that other speaker or participant. And sometimes I've had, what I really enjoy is I ask the organizers to invite the heads of all of the minority and other identitarian student groups. So I recently did a talk in such a format at Suffolk Law School. And after an initial interview by a faculty member there, who, by the way, is a world-renowned expert in anti-bullying and anti-harassment, so that was a nice compliment to have that perspective there. There was then one question each that was asked on behalf of their groups by the leaders of the Black law students, the Jewish law students, the gay law students, the Muslim law students, the women law students, and then there was some scholarly groups like the media. And they, in the process, which I had encouraged beforehand, that they consult with the members of their groups for what they thought is the most important challenge to throw at me or question to ask of me, that already it was starting to get the discussion flowing. And then they had a stake and they had an overflow crowd. They said it was a titled lecture that's given at least once a year, and they had to bring in extra chairs. And, you know, they were at first a little bit surprised, because a titled lecture, you usually picture somebody standing at the podium and pontificating for an hour. And this was quite different, but they were so enthusiastic about it. I think they said they're going to do future events that way. So that to me is a very constructive way of interacting with students of widely divergent views. And one other strategy that I use, which is not a strategy, it's really consistent with my educational mission, is what I always did in my own classroom, that I will ask the students not what their own view is on a certain issue, but articulate, or, you know, say, what is the strongest argument for X? Okay, that's excellent. Now, what is the strongest counter argument against X? And certainly that kind of ability to articulate different perspectives is especially important for law students. But in my view, it's important for, it's not important, it's essential too. It is critical thinking and critical inquiry, which in my view should begin as early as pre-K or whenever kids start being educated. And the other benefit is that they are not identifying. They don't have to personally identify with a certain perspective. So that liberates them to set out the view without feeling that they're going to be pilloried as, you know, actually espousing whatever an unpopular position is.
Yeah. It's amazing that law students would have a hard time with that, or even be surprised by that assignment. I mean, that is the essence of being a lawyer, is it not? And, you know, we hear stories about, I can't remember which campus this was, but female law students not wanting to talk about rape at all, like this was triggering to them in the classroom. And, you know, I don't know, we hear these stories and I don't know how much of it is hyperbole. It's the kind of thing that, you know,
I don't think
media loves to run away with.
You know,
okay. Okay. So it does happen. We're not just being like heterodox.
Oh, yes. And I'll be very precise, because I know what you're talking about. It was a 2017 article in the New Yorker by Jeannie Suk Gerson of Harvard Law School, speaking about, not only Harvard Law School, but many other law schools. I have the highest respect for her integrity and probity, and that she would not engage in hyperbole. And I interviewed her before, spoke to her before adverting to that problem in the new preface to the new edition of Defending Pornography. And she said, it's, you know, the problem has continued and has gotten worse. I recently, you know, this is just anecdotal, but consistent with the more systemic conversations that Jeannie, who teaches criminal law, has had. I was recently speaking to a faculty member whom I don't know, a male who teaches criminal law at a law school in the Midwest. He was speaking to me for a completely different reason, to get a job reference for a candidate. And somehow this topic came up, and he told me that, as, and he said, it is rare and it's controversial that he is still including rape in his criminal law classes. You know, what starts at Harvard, a lot of these trends tend to start at the really elite, fancy institutions. But when they trickle down to, as this was, you know, a Midwestern state law school, or, you know, a non-prestigious private institution such as the one where I taught, New York Law School, or even community colleges, you know, that's really becoming very culturally pervasive. And he told me that every time he goes to teach a class about rape or sexual assault, he said, "I'm terrified." And I thought, wow. And, you know, and I understand that. And he has a lot to be terrified about, because all it takes is one complainant, not even somebody in his own class, that goes viral. And, you know, your career can be sabotaged. But, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about this example, Megan, because I traced that in the new preface to the new edition of Defending Pornography. This goes back to McKinnon and Dworkin. I mean, McKinnon said, not only did she say that women are inherently raped every time we're not only posing for pornography, but engaged in sex, right? There was no distinction between sex and rape, but also that even verbal descriptions of rape are rape. There was this infamous situation when her boyfriend of the time, to whom you alluded, Jeffrey Messon, was threatening to actually kill. McKinnon's boyfriend, Jeffrey Messon, literally, I'm not exaggerating, said that he wanted to kill a book reviewer for the Philadelphia Inquirer named Carlin Romano, who had done this thought experiment in his review of one of McKinnon's books, you know, taking her up on her equation between depictions of rape and actual rape. And he had some kind of thought experiment. I think he was a philosopher. Philosophers have these thought experiments about McKinnon being raped. And that led her and Messon and people in her camp to say, that is not distinguishable from an actual rape. You have raped Catherine McKinnon by writing that review. And everybody at the time took that as rhetorical hyperbole, right? We understand you're making a point. But I think that that distinction, that elision between the words, let's say violent words or racist words, sexist words, and the actual violent or racist or sexist conduct, that distinction has been obliterated on college campuses, and to some extent even beyond college campuses, when students say, you know, words are violence, speech is violence. And that has led to such devastating consequences, not only in terms of suppressing speech that is critically important, especially on a college campus, but it has also led to another serious problem, which is that literal violence is seen as justifiable when it is wielded against speakers whose ideas you disagree with. In the latest FIRE College Pulse survey that I referred to, only 27% of students said that violence is never justified to respond to ideas that you disagree with. Only 27% it said it's never justified. The remaining, 73% said it's either sometimes justified or often justified.
It's so crazy because so the very crowd that says we need to prosecute people who commit sex crimes, we need to hold sexual predators to account, et cetera, are saying we refuse to train lawyers to do this work because it's too harmful for them to get through the curriculum. Like, it's so incoherent.
It's very tragic to me coming up in my generation as one of the, you know, we were the first cohort, significant numbers of women to go to law school at a time when, you know, I went to law school at a time when there were zero female faculty members at Harvard Law School, and we were only 10% of the class. And at the time, the rape laws were terrible. I mean, it was almost impossible to successfully prosecute someone for rape. And rape was not being taught in law schools for the opposite reason, that it was seen as a women's issue, you know, and not so important. And it was a big crusade on the part of feminists at the time, especially those of us in law school, to be sure that rape was taught precisely so that the laws could be reformed as they were and so that women could become sex crimes prosecutors as they did. And I could not agree with you more that this is, that's why I keep saying so-called feminists and so-called radicals, because to me, it's a very reactionary anti-feminist position.
Yeah. Well, speaking of this kind of contradiction and cognitive dissonance, I want to ask you about the ACLU. You were the president from 1991 to 2008. 2008's kind of a long time ago now. I mean, the ACLU is really different than it used to be. I know there's a lot of polarization within the organization. I know there's generational divides. I know people, Ira Glasser, who was the executive director, I think he was overlapped with you.
Yes, he did.
For a lot of that time. So there's a great film about him called Mighty Ira that touches on the Skokie event in depth. And, you know, he talks a lot about these conflicts within the ACLU. You know, I don't expect you to throw them under the bus, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts about the fact that, you know, we get messages coming out of the ACLU saying that they don't believe in due process, that, you know, sexual assault cases offered more protections to students defending themselves against these allegations. For instance, you know, the ACLU says it promotes an unfair process, inappropriately favoring the accused. What?
So, Megan, it is such a complicated issue, and I really appreciate your acknowledging that. So let me make just a few points, because I think we could spend easily an hour on this topic alone. The ACLU is a large and complicated organization, which it has a federalist structure. So there's a national organization, and then there are many state-based so-called affiliates, which have their own autonomy to a large extent. And throughout my long experience, direct experience with ACLU, there were often conflicts between the national organization and one or more affiliates or affiliates with each other. We even had cases where the ACLU would be on two sides in the Supreme Court, where the national was taking one position and one or more affiliates was taking another position in cases where there are plausible claims of competing civil liberties interests that are at issue in a particular case. And let me give you one example. And then, as you indicated, you know, debates among ourselves. When I was president, my major institutional responsibility was to chair the national ACLU National Board of Directors, which consisted of more than 80 very argumentative, articulate people, most of whom were lawyers and all of whom knew Robert's Rules of Order backwards and forward. And we would debate each other over these issues and almost never have a unanimous vote on any issue. And the one that I remember being very polarizing, and it led to a lot of media coverage in the early 90s, just to show that these debates up within the ACLU, the debates about the ACLU, the media coverage of the ACLU supposedly selling out civil liberties is also a phenomenon that has been recycled. You know, you can go look and see major articles in Time Magazine, USA Today, among others, about how the ACLU was being accused by some within it of supposedly selling out civil liberties in the particular context were debates we were having about the then new concept of sexual harassment and the extent to which it could consist of expression in the workplace and on campus. And I mentioned Wendy Kaminer, who certainly is a very, very strong proponent of free speech as well as feminism. I appointed her to chair the committee that recommended policy to the national board. And we were very deeply split about exactly where you draw the line. I think everybody recognized that some expression in certain contexts could and should be punished in the workplace and in educational settings as creating a hostile environment and therefore violating the equal rights of women in those very important settings. But the devil is in the details, and there was a lot of debate about the details. And, you know, now you're talking about the context of a very important context of Title IX and how do you fairly ensure that people who are victims of sexual assault, including sexual harassment, can bring the perpetrators to justice, but on, of course, protecting the due process rights of those who are accused. And, you know, I would say reasonable civil libertarians can disagree and do disagree. And I have publicly disagreed with the position that the ACLU has taken on that issue. And I've had exchanges with David Cole, the ACLU's national legal director, about that. I have the most enormous respect for him as a lawyer and civil libertarian. By the way, he has been absolutely ferocious in his defense of free speech for hate speech and anti-civil liberty speech. He's written wonderful pieces in the New York Review. He's taken a lot of heat from within the organization as well as outside. So this is somebody whose views on, you know, he's not somebody who's going to sell out civil liberties for wokeness. But we just, you know, have respectful disagreements. Then I do think there is a serious generational divide in general that runs through our society, and including running through institutions that traditionally have been particularly supportive of free speech, starting with academia. You know, there have been very detailed surveys that show every decade, from the oldest to the youngest, that are now active on campus, the support for free speech is higher the older you go and lower the younger you go. And unfortunately, we've seen that pattern in your profession, journalism. We've seen it in publishing. We've seen it in theater and other cultural institutions. We see it in libraries. And that's why I am so committed to speaking with, and now you understand why I say with rather than to, young people, including not only on college campuses, but I do all the middle and high school talks that I can wangle so far.
Oh, wow.
Nobody invited me to speak to a grade school, but I also speak to the teachers at those schools because they have enormous power and influence. And there's a lot of indication that ed schools are not doing a great job in instilling respect or knowledge for classical liberal principles, including free speech.
Yeah. Well, I feel also like organizations like the ACLU have been victims of social media. I mean, I do think that people, whoever controls the Twitter accounts for whether it's, you know, political leader or, you know, a prominent influential nonprofit, whoever is doing the tweeting doesn't actually necessarily represent the views of the organization, although they should, because that is kind of the public facing expression of the organization. But I think I always feel like social media is still kind of not in its infancy, but in its toddlerhood, and it behaves like an out of control toddler sometimes.
Well, Nate, let me make 2 points about that. First, I do want to say that for all the heat the ACLU gets from, let's say, libertarians and those who are really adamant, as I am, about free speech, for supposedly not doing enough to defend controversial speech, the ACLU is clearly strongly attacked from the left for allegedly doing too much to defend controversial speech. And by the way, that was true throughout my leadership as well. I wrote an article in the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review, which they commissioned from me in the early 90s, in which I was explaining how the ACLU has not sold out in either direction. And in fact, the fact that we're constantly attacked from both sides is a rough indicator that we're probably getting it about right. But let me give you an example of the ACLU, and to the extent I'm still identified with it, I personally have been receiving so much attack and criticism and dissent and people saying they're resigning their membership because the ACLU recently was in the Supreme Court arguing in support of the First Amendment free speech and freedom of association rights of the National Rifle Association. And liberals hate that. Let me just say, I'm just so shocked that people don't understand that, you know, if an administration, this was the state government, thinks that the NRA is a dangerous organization and therefore puts pressure on state regulators to threaten banks and insurance companies and other financial institutions that they better not do business with the NRA, which means basically putting the NRA out of business. You know, another administration can come along and take that same posture with respect to Planned Parenthood or the ACLU or your gun rights, you know, gun control organization. People don't get it. And in going back to, you know, the historic Skokie case in 1977, exactly 50 years later, not too long ago, the ACLU did exactly the same thing in Charlottesville, 2017. We were the ones who represented the Unite the Right racist demonstrators. Again, hardly supporting their message to the contrary, but standing up for their right to voice their messages when the only evidence as to the reason why their parade permit was withdrawn at the last minute, attemptedly withdrawn by the city council, was because of distaste for their viewpoint. The chief of police came into the court hearing and said, there's absolutely no evidence that there are any plans for violence. We've got it under control. If there is violence, we'll be able to protect people. Obviously, that turned out to be false, tragically, but we were right to the principles we argued were correct, and the judge ruled correctly. And again, we've taken tremendous amount of heat for that. I can't tell you how often the ACLU has been blamed for the violence that did occur there and told that our blood is on our hands. The other point that I'd like to make, I think that's enough. But it's a complicated question.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And those are good examples. It's easy to get spun out over Chase Strangio's tweets.
Sorry, that's the other point I want to make. Thank you.
Okay, go for it.
Because I think it's really important. The ACLU has always defended free speech in the workplace for employees. And, you know, as a constitutional law matter, private sector workplaces have no First Amendment obligations, but we've argued consistent with general free speech principles, it would be desirable and a good public policy position for employers to allow a certain amount of free speech in the workplace, given how many hours people spend there. And so we've always felt we had to put our money where our mouth is. And we've always had organizational policies that, except for the very top positions like the national executive director or legal director, who are inevitably going to be seen as speaking for the whole organization, that most employees do have their own free speech rights, certainly if it's their own Twitter account, and they have to disclaim, they have to say, I am speaking for myself and not for the ACLU. That has always been our position. And so I think that's a defensible position. Now, I have not been privy to any more recent debates and discussions that might have taken place given the changes in social media to which you refer. But that is the underlying principle, Megan. And I do think it's a laudable one.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair enough. And we should say, in case anybody's confused, Chase Strangio is Deputy Director for Transgender Justice with the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project. So, gosh,
I didn't even... That Chase's controversial tweets, which I strongly disagreed with, I think they were clearly labeled as speaking for Chase's own perspective and not that of the project, right?
Okay, that's fair. And I didn't realize Chase was the Deputy Director, so...
There are many deputies.
Okay.
It's like banks, right? Everybody is. What's the main title?
Vice president.
Yes,
many
exactly.
Vice presidents. Yeah, exactly. Well, we could talk forever, but before I let you go, I really just kind of want to circle back to where we were in the beginning of this conversation, which is your relationship to feminism and your relationship to being a woman and being an outspoken woman, being an ambitious woman. We've seen feminism, whatever that means, change so dramatically over the decades. We went from second wave, which you were very involved in, and that's certainly what shaped me throughout my childhood in the 70s and into the 80s. This discussion became really different around the 2010s. I'm wondering how you feel kind of about the state of women and women's rights today, especially with defending pornography being reissued. Where are we with this?
That's such a great question, Megan. Surprisingly, nobody has asked me that question. I'm constantly being interviewed and rarely am I asked something for the first time. And maybe it's because it's such a basic question, but it's such an important one. First of all, I'm an activist, and as an activist, you are a congenital optimist. I'm pulling my glass here in front of me, and I always see the glass half full. I really do. And, it may be in part because I've lived a substantial number of decades and seen enormous, just almost unfathomable progress on all the human rights issues since my childhood, including women's rights. When I was in college, the Supreme Court had not yet issued a single decision in which it interpreted the equal protection guarantee in the Constitution, which is completely open-ended, right? No state shall deprive any person of the equal protection of the laws. It had never applied that open-ended guarantee to women. To the contrary, it had very recently, cases as recently as the 60s and early 70s expressly held that the Equal Protection Clause did not have any application at all to gender discrimination. And of course, it wasn't until 1973 that the Supreme Court correctly, in my view, held that the Constitution guaranteed a right to choose abortion. So, the gay rights movement was basically unheard of. It was completely in the closet. And, there were so many other then new movements for human rights which have emerged and made enormous strides since then. So, of course, we have setbacks, Roe versus Wade being a very important one. Of course, we're fighting some of the same battles over and over again, including battles to defend freedom for sexually explicit speech, which includes even classic works of literature and so forth. But on the whole, we are constantly making progress. That famous statement by Martin Luther King about the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. I would say the pace of closer approximation toward justice is increasingly rapid. And I think I agree with the many commentators who have cited the just enormous, breathtaking progress in the movement for marriage equality and LGBTQ+ rights in general. That went from, when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were running for president, even after he was elected president, he still opposed marriage equality, and now it's got enormous support. And, even on issues where we are constantly told that we are so retrograde and we're backsliding and we're never going to solve problems of racism or sexism, I dissent I very strongly
decide. It's never been a worse time, don't you know? It's never been a worse time to be a woman or a this or a that.
And, you know, going back to a point you made earlier, that people will try to undermine your argument by pointing to your identity. I really reject that as a mode of argumentation. But we know that many people do think that way. So I'm especially heartened that we have such brilliant thinkers and writers and analysts who are people of color who are making exactly that point. John McWhorter is a good example, and Coleman Hughes is another good example, but with very powerful evidence. And more generally, we have Steven Pinker did a recent book about how, you know, this is the best of times, and there's such overwhelming evidence for that.
Well, this has been great. It's such a privilege to talk with you, Nadine. And we should say that you're going to be joining us for our Unspeakeasy event in Chicago in June. So I really look forward
to it. Oh, you think we'll still have anything to talk about, Megan?
Yes, we'll have plenty. And it's going to be, you know, it's our favorite forum. It will be, I'll kick off a few questions and then our group will.
I was saying that with a huge smile. I
think. Yes.
I don't think we could ever run out.
Well, no, this has been wonderful. Well, thank you for all the work that you've done. Congratulations on the reissue of Defending Pornography, which is there's a lot more to defend than there used to be.
Yeah. Well, right. We never got into that. Okay, for another interview.
Yes. Well, come back. Come back on the podcast sometime, and I will see you in June. But thanks so much for talking.
Thank you so much, Megan.
That was my interview with the legendary free speech advocate, Nadine Strossen. Nadine is a New York Law School professor emerita and a senior fellow at FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. She was national president of the ACLU from 1991 to 2008. Her 1995 book, Defending Pornography, Free Speech, Sex, and the Fight for Women's Rights, has just been reissued by NYU Press. Again, paying subscribers, which you are not yet one if you are hearing me say this, get to hear about 10 extra minutes of this conversation where we talk about not having children. It doesn't really have anything to do with free speech, but it is poignant and very honest and also hilarious. So to hear that part, go to megandom.substack.com and become a paying subscriber. Also, as you heard me say at the end, Nadine will be a guest speaker at our first ever co-ed Unspeakeasy retreat, which is happening in Chicago on June 4th and 5th. Our other speakers include Eric Smith, who's a professor of rhetorics, and he's the co-founder and president of Free Black Thought, and also author and journalist Lisa Sellen Davis, who covers the new gender movement like no one else. The retreat is filling up rapidly, but to find out more, you can go to theunspeakeasy.com. I'll be back next week with another super nuanced guest. Thanks for listening. See you then. Thank you.